Continuing our study of ecclesiology, tonight we will, assuming that we get to the point on that clock where it says 7 o'clock, we will have spent now 3 full days in this study of theology over the past 90 different lectures that I have given. 3 days. I mean that literally. 3 24-hour periods. So if we had done this theology class in one straight session, you would have sat here for 72 straight hours in order to get that material. That's how much there is in theology. Okay, theology is not a simple, Jesus loves me, this I know, for the Bible tells me. So there's much more to it than that. And having said that, I want to add then to our discussion of ecclesiology an area of discussion I really don't find in most systematics in regards to the study of ecclesiology. It's mentioned, it's kind of there, it's behind the scenes, but I really want to bring it out into the open and talk about it specifically and directly and straightforwardly, okay? You remember at the beginning of our discussion of ecclesiology, we talked about what the church is, okay? Remember, an ontological phrase, what is the church? And we talked about the marks that make a church, what distinguishes a church from every other organization on the planet, what makes the church unique. And we talked about the 3 specific marks of the organization that make it a church. The proper preaching of the word, the proper application of discipline, the proper practice of the ordinances. Okay, those 3 things separate the church from every other institution on the planet. I mean, they don't do any of those things at the Kiwanis Club. Okay, so the church is something. But would it be fair to say that we also should talk about what the church does? Now, we've already started that discussion in some sense by talking about the ordinances, because that's the most obvious thing that the church does, right? I mean, the church practices the 2 ordinances, and that's really where most systematics go. They'll talk about the ordinances, or what they would call the sacraments in some, as the things the church does. But I want to talk different from that. I want to talk about the actions of the church in light of its nature as the church. And I think the reason I want to talk about this more than anything else is because in my study of ecclesiology over the years, and I'd call myself an ecclesiologist even more than a theologian, is that one of the failures that I have sought in the modern church in the days that I have been a believer is that nobody really talks about what the church ought to be doing, and so the church just goes about doing whatever it thinks it ought to do. Nobody's ever really sat down and says, is there an ecclesiological reason for why we ought to be doing or not doing certain things? Okay, setting aside the ordinances, the most obvious reality of that, what about everything else that goes on in the church? So what I want to talk about is the operation of the church as the instrument of Christ to advance his cause in the world. Or should I call it its ecclesiological mission? Okay, its mission as an organization called the church. What is the mission of this thing called the church? What is it supposed to be accomplishing in the world? Like I said, the marks of the church define its nature, what makes it distinct. But I believe there's a mission that the church has been charged with undertaking in the world. It's not just an organization that popped up just because Jesus went back to his Father's side, and so the Christians were all left to, well, let's just kind of gather together and figure out what we're supposed to be doing. I believe that Jesus mandated the organization, this thing called the church, to have a mission. To have a mission, to have a purpose. Okay? So I would entitle this section, actually, the Healthy Church. What is a healthy church? Which implies, by the way, that there would be unhealthy churches too, okay? All right, so let's talk about what the healthy church is. I mean, any church or any organization, I should say, that claims to be a church must not only be defined properly by its distinctives, but it must also act in ways that are consistent with the intention of its founder. Wouldn't you think? If it is Jesus who says, I will build my church, and the gates of hell will not prevail against it, then would not it follow that if Jesus is the founder of the church, then we should be asking ourselves the question, what is the mission he established for the organization? What is it that he believes it should be doing? We have all kinds of opinions about what we think it ought to be doing. What does he believe it should be doing? Okay, so let's put it this way. Let's go back and think about, let's connect ecclesiology to Christology. Christology is the theological study of Christ, the second person of the Trinity, who he is, all right? It's his church, agreed? It's his church. Okay, so there should be, I think, a Christology. And if there is a Christology, what does the Christology of the church assume that Christ himself came to do? And then what by extension would be what he expects his body to do after he leaves that body to operate in the world? You see where I'm going? If Christ is the one who establishes the church by virtue of what he does to begin with, would it not be reasonable to assume that he's assuming that his body, as it continues in the world, with him not physically present, but his spirit present, wouldn't that imply a consistency between what he came to do and what the church ought to be doing? I think so. I think this is one of those areas that, as I said, doesn't get a great deal of attention. What does the Christology of the church assume that Christ came to do? And from that, what is extrapolated for the body to do as an extension of him in the world? Okay, now let me give you an example, okay? So you'll understand if you don't. In the early 20th century, there was a theology that became prevalent known as liberal theology. In the middle part of the 20th century, it morphed into a form of theology called liberation theology. Liberation theology is now becoming a very real thing in the church in the 21st century. In fact, all this discussion that you're hearing about social justice out of the church and racial harmony and all these kind of things, all of that is simply liberation theology repackaged from the early 20th century, the mid-20th century to now, okay? The writer of Ecclesiastes is absolutely right. There's nothing new under the sun. It's all the same, okay? It's just packaged differently. Okay. Now, consider this. In liberation Christology, not liberation theology, in liberation Christology, the view of Jesus was that he came to be an example for us of how we are then to liberate others from their oppressions. The idea of liberal theology, which became liberation theology, was that we are to go out into the world and help people out of the oppressions that they have because that's what Jesus came to do. He came to relieve poverty. He came to break down social and racial classes. He came to bring about equality where there was inequality and so forth of the various matters of people-to-people relationships. That was his job. That's what he came to do. He came to be an example for that. Okay? Now, if that's a Christology, an understanding of Christ, then you will find almost a direct parallel of that understanding of Christ then to the nature of the church itself, right? Well, what's the mission of the liberal/liberation church? The answer is, well, because Jesus came to show us how to do that, then we're supposed to go out and do it. So the primary job of the church as an institution is to go out and focus its activities on expressions of social justice and temporal need meeting. Go out and meet people's needs. That's the primary job of the church. That's what it's about. I've visited churches like this. I've heard preachers who have said specifically from their pulpits that the point of the church is that Jesus came to be an example, and he's an example for us of how to go out and meet needs, and so you should come to the church and worship him by, I get that word, by going from the church out into the world and bringing forth these kinds of harmonizations, solving the problems of the world, because that's what Jesus came to do. In fact, I opened a commentary this week on a book I'm considering doing after Ruth. And the very first page, I mean, I'm not even three paragraphs into the book, and the book is arguing for that position. Now, that's precisely what Jesus came to do. That when he walked the earth, what he did was he met with the poor and the downtrodden and the outcast, and therefore he was a great example to all of them about how to solve these kinds of problems. No mention of his sacrificial death, no mention of his atoning sacrifice, no mention of propitiation or wrath, just Jesus came to be an example. Now you'll notice the parallel. The Christology leads to the ecclesiology. How people understand Jesus becomes the way by which they understand the church. In other words, they understand the mission of the church, its goals, purposes, and functions, by virtue of how they understand him. And so they come to an understanding of him based on this liberation idea, and thus the church becomes exactly an instrument of that kind of Christology. If you haven't figured out why it is the church operates the way that it does in the West, is because of a faulty Christology, not because of a faulty ecclesiology. Ecclesiology follows from Christology. How you see Christ determines how you see the church, not the other way around. Now, in Reformed Christology then, in the kind of Christology we would advocate here, Jesus came to redeem a people from their bondage to sin and death, in accordance with the Father's eternal decree and to his eternal glory. That the intention of the work of Christ wasn't to come to be an example, but actually to come and offer himself as a sacrifice on behalf of a people who were in bondage to sin and death. That their real oppression wasn't their poverty, their real oppression is their sin. And their state before a holy God in which they are condemned automatically by virtue of being rebels against God. And he has come, this Christ has come, to redeem them from their bondage. That's a Christology. Now notice what it does to the church. Thus the church focuses its activities on addressing the spiritual realities of people with the message of the gospel in order to reveal the elect from the world and, more importantly, to glorify God above all temporal realities. In other words, it's not a focus on the things of this world. Those are not unimportant. Okay, but they're secondary. In fact, one could argue they're tertiary. They're really not all that important because temporal matters come and go. Jesus himself said, the poor you will always have with you, but I will not always be with you. Okay, so a Reformed Christology says Christ didn't come to solve my poverty issue. Christ came to solve my sin issue, my guilt issue. That's what he came to solve. And when he came to solve that, then by definition, the body, the church that extends from him, that should be its focus as it goes out into the world. Now, you will notice, if you're paying attention here, if I haven't put you to sleep yet, that the two pictures I just painted are extraordinarily different, aren't they? But you will notice that the genesis of both of them starts from your view of Christ. So it's from how you see Jesus. Who is this Jesus? What did he actually come to do? If he came to solve people's temporal issues, then the church goes this way. If he came to solve people's eternal issues, then the church goes this way. And what you are seeing around you, by the way, what you are seeing around you is a very strong divergence of those two particular perspectives. You're seeing churches who are going all in on the temporal meeting side of the equation. Because they're saying, you know what? That's what our culture wants from us. That's what makes us relevant to our culture. And so that's the view of Christ that we have. So we're just going to run with it in that direction. At least they're being honest about their Christology. On the other hand, some of us are saying, wait a minute. That direction is going in the wrong direction. Because that is not a proper view of Christ. So, What I'm saying here is that the activities of the church will reflect directly on its understanding of all of the previous discussion theologically. By definition, a God-centered theology and a Christ-centered Christology will be entirely different from a man-centered theology and a world-centered Christology. There's a very real difference between those things. So I want to argue that there is a mission for the church. It begins with a proper Christology. I've laid that Christology out for you in the past. I've given you a nutshell of it here, okay? So I believe that there is a mission for the church. Now, where would we find it? Obviously, we turn to the Word, okay? Again, if we're going to be sola scriptura people, and we're going to have a proper Christology in which Christ thinks the Word is most important because it's His Word, okay? So we're going to have to go to the Scriptures, all right? We'll do that. And maybe we ought to go and listen to Him somewhere, don't you think? I mean, after all, He is the Lord of the church, so why don't we take His Word? So why don't we go someplace where He actually commissioned His church? Isn't that the same word? Co-mission, right? Commission, to set in motion a mission. Commission, all right. Where's that found? You know where it's found, Matthew chapter 28. I think that the mission of the church is best expressed in this commission. And I'm going to argue, I'm going to state it frankly, that I don't think that this is just what most people think it is. Okay? Let me read for you the entirety of the paragraph. I'm going to start in verse 16. Now the 11 disciples went to Galilee, to the mountain which Jesus had directed them. Okay, pause. 11. Judas is dead, right? He went out and killed himself. The apostles have spent now some time with this Christ, 40 days roughly with Him. They have seen Him in a number of ways. He has taught them, etc. And now it is time for Him to go back to His Father's side so that the Spirit can come. Remember, He told them, I go away so that the Spirit can come. If I don't go away, the Spirit doesn't come, so I'm going to go away, so He comes. So He's getting to that particular place, okay? So He takes them to a mountain in which He had directed them. Meet me here. And so they go there. The 11. Verse 17, and when they saw Him, they worshipped Him. But some doubted. Interesting phrase, isn't it? Now, who is He talking about? The 11. Okay, so what you got is 11 men who have spent 40 days with this risen Jesus, and two things are true about them. Number one, they do recognize that He is God, worthy to be worshipped. Okay, so they recognize Him as one to be worshipped, but they're also struggling with the realities of being human, which is, in their flesh, looking at Him and wondering, I don't understand all of this. I don't get it. I don't understand why my mind doesn't fully grasp everything that I should know about this. And so if you're, by the way, one of those in that condition who once in a while questions some of these sorts of things, read that verse. You're in good company. Okay? Now, we do know, of course, as we turn the page to the book of Acts, that the Son sends His Spirit to sort of solve some of that issue, but not entirely. You can't read Romans 7 without coming to the realization that, you know what, you don't get out of this life without a real struggle. There's going to be doubt. Verse 18, and Jesus came and said to them, quote, all authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. How much authority? Over what? Heaven and earth. How much of the creation and outside creation does that encompass? All of it. What is Jesus saying? The Father has given to me absolutely all sovereignty over all things, period, end of sentence. Full stop. Therefore, go. Notice the therefore. Because the authority has been given to me, I now give to you a commission. Go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe all that I have commanded you. Greek students of this verse know that there's only one verb in that commission that's actually an imperative. Only one, and it's the words make disciples. Go, baptize and teach are all in a form subordinate to the imperative of make disciples. In other words, you make disciples by going, baptizing, and teaching. Okay, see that? So there's a commission. Go, make disciples. And then he closes it by saying, and behold, I am with you always to the end of the age. I am not leaving you as orphans. I'm not leaving you alone. You're not going to do this on your own. You're not going to do this by yourself. I'm going to be with you, but not in the way that you think, or not in the way that I'm going to be walking around with you, but I will be with you. Now, I'm going to argue that from this commission, there are three primary activities of the church as a part of its mission. Okay? Not just things we do, like Lord's Supper and baptism. Missional things. By the way, that is a very popular word in modern evangelicalism. Missional. You hear it all the time. You read some of the megachurch websites and they will have that word plastered everywhere because it's missional. We're here to do a mission. Plumb the depths of their website. You won't actually find a mission. It's just a nice word. But it's a word that has meaning if we use it in its proper value. I'm going to argue that there are three things that the church is to be doing as its mission. Number one, the church is to be a place of worship. Worship. Second, the church is to be an instrument of discipleship. That one's not hard to see. And thirdly, the church is to be an instrument of evangelism. It is to be a place of worship, just as those 11 men who walked up that mountain and saw this Jesus, what did they do? They worshiped him. What do you think he expected of them? He expected them to worship him. It is certainly to be an instrument of discipleship. He told them to go do that. That's the imperative. And the evangelism, it is an implication. It's an implication to advance the work or the gospel of the church in the world as he resides with the disciples down through the church age. It's his message, the gospel, his message, thus as he is with the church, as he is with the body will then by definition be an organization promoting his message. Now, you will notice, by the way, that most preachers that preach this passage just preach one mission from it, and that is the evangelism part. But I would argue that the other two are key here as well. And so I'm actually going to leave evangelism to the end. Because I am convinced that the most important part of the Great Commission is worship. So let's talk about the mission of worship. The mission of worship is the church as a people worshiping God. Okay, now get these last words. As he demands. The mission of the church is the church as a people worshiping God as he demands. Now, how many of you would agree with the following statement, that worship is central to what it means to be human? Don't answer that question too quickly. That worship is central to what it means to be human. Now, there's a part of us that says, is that really true? Because all these reprobate people don't worship God, right? They worship themselves. But I didn't say worship of God was central to us. I said worship is inherent to us. In fact, that's correct. Worship is a part of the divine decree of God. God himself has decreed that he is to be worshiped. He has decreed it as a part of his divine decree. The worship of God is central to the redemptive historical revelation of God in this world. In other words, all that you read from Genesis 1 all the way through to Revelation 21, the whole message all along the way is, I am a God who is worthy to be worshipped, and I expect you to do so. Now, let's think about how that works itself out in redemptive history. We can go back to Genesis chapter 2, right? The very beginning of Genesis chapter 2 is a very interesting paragraph at the beginning of Genesis 2. It belongs in Genesis 1. But at the very beginning of Genesis 2, it says that God created the world in 6 days, and on the seventh day he rested. And that is linked to the idea of an Old Testament Sabbath day. Remember in Exodus 20, when God gives the 10 words to Moses, when he gives the word regarding worship, he links it to his own creative work back in Genesis 1. He says, I worked for 6 days, created the world, then took a day to rest. You, Israelites, are to have 1 day out of 7 that you set aside for the purpose of worshiping me just as I instituted from the very beginning of the creation of the world. Let me put it to you this way. Here's what God did. He went to the Israelites and he said, look, he said, I created a creation mandate that goes something like this. Because of the curse, you will work 6 days of toil that will lead to your death. But you will have 1 day in which you will work that will lead to life. See the difference? Because of what happened to Adam and when he sinned, God came to him and cursed him and said, you're going back to the dust of the ground. So you're going to toil. 6 days out of the week, you're going to toil, and you're going to toil, and you're going to toil, and you're never going to get anywhere. You're going to work, you're going to work, you're going to work, and you're never going to get anywhere. It's always going to be the same thing, right? I mean, wouldn't it be great if you worked this week, you earned a paycheck, and that paycheck would be sufficient for the rest of your life? Wouldn't that be good, right? Didn't have to go back to work. I worked, that's it, it's done. But it doesn't work that way. What do you got to do? Monday morning comes, you got to go back to work. You got to earn more. And you got to keep doing it week after week after week after week until you finally fall into the ground dead. That's what God has cursed. But God says, wait a minute. I'm going to grant you one of those days out of the week where the work that you do doesn't lead you to dust, it leads you to me, which is to life. So he establishes in the very creation itself 6 days of toil that lead to death, but 1 day of worship that leads to life. By the way, the original Christians were all Jewish, right? Remember? Acts 2? They're all Jewish. They were all there in Jerusalem on the day of Pentecost. Peter goes out and preaches a great sermon. 3,000 people come to faith, okay? Guess what they did? They added a day of worship to their calendar. Okay. A lot of people think they just changed the day from the Sabbath day on Saturday to Sunday. No. They added a day. They went to the synagogue with their Jewish friends on Saturday, just like they'd always been doing, and then on Sunday, they went and gathered with the other Christians and worshiped. And over time, that morphed into the day of worship moving from the Sabbath day to the first day of the week. Over time. Oh, and it's interesting to me, too. If you want to be really symbolic about this, the Jews ended their week with worship. The Christians started their week with worship. Notice the focal change. The Jews went out and toiled for 6 days and then stumbled into the synagogue and collapsed on Saturday and said, oh, we made it another week, thank God. And the Christians went out and said, no, before I even go to work this week, I'm going to walk in here and worship this God. See the difference? They saw in Christ something different about their understanding of worship. Worship by the Israelites was central to the law, right? Remember, I've talked often about the fact that the law of God was composed of three primary components. A moral code, which sat as a foundation underneath all of Israelite activity, best described in the Ten Commandments. Okay, and then two great pillars that stood upon that foundation. One of those pillars was the civil law, how they related to one another. And then the other pillar, which was much bigger, which was the ceremonial code. All of the particular things that God had specified in the construction of the tabernacle, the ark, the mercy seat, the altar, the priests, the sacrifices, the feast days, and all the other stuff that went along with the people worshiping their God. I find it absolutely fascinating that a proper outline of the book of Exodus goes something like this. You start with Moses' biography, a little short biography of Moses, and then a few chapters of them being taken out of Egypt by the power of God and the plagues, and then they make their way for a few chapters down to the mountain of Sinai, and then there's a chapter or two in which he gives them the law, and then there's a chapter where they ratify it, and then the rest of the book is all about how they are to worship. now that they have been set free from the law of sin and death in Egypt. They recognize this. And as you study the history of Israel, as you study the history of the people of Israel, what do you discover? They had two different exiles, remember? They were cast away by the Assyrians in 721-22 BC, and then they were cast the second time away in 586 BC by the Babylonians. And both times, the reason that they are cast away is specifically because they fail to worship God in His way. Both times. If you don't believe me, read 1 Kings 17. Wait a minute. 2 Kings. I think it's 2 Kings. 2 Kings 17, right? Let me just verify, because I think I wrote 1 Kings here, but I think it's, yes, it's 2 Kings. I accidentally wrote 1 Kings. Verse 7 of that chapter. Just let me read this. You'll get it. And this occurred, what? The people being carted away to Assyria in the previous verse. And this occurred because the people of Israel had sinned against the Lord their God, who had brought them up out of the land of Egypt, and so forth and so on. And the people of Israel did secretly against the Lord their God things that were not right. They built for themselves high places in their towns, from watchtower to fortified city. They set up for themselves pillars and asherim in every high hill and every green tree. And there they made offerings on all the high places the nations did, whom the Lord carried away before them. And what is the writer saying? They borrowed the worship practices of the pagans all around them, dismissed the proper worship that he had demanded of them, and so God came along and said, not acceptable. You worship me the way I expect you to worship me, period. Or you will be exiled. See it? Both exiles are because of this reality. You come into the New Testament. John chapter 4, Jesus meets with a Samaritan woman and they're having a discussion about where you're supposed to worship and what worship is supposed to be about. And Jesus makes his own presence the essence of true worship. He makes his own presence the essence of true worship. The coming of the Christ was to seek true worshipers of God. What does he say? Remember John 4:23? But the hour is coming and is now here. What does he mean by that? I'm standing here, Jesus is speaking, when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth, for the Father is seeking such people to worship him. I have come, Jesus says, to seek those who are willing to worship. You, Samaritan woman, have a very bizarre idea about what worship is supposed to be about. But let me tell you this. There's coming a day when worship is going to be done the way it's supposed to be done, and I'm the one who's come to bring it. This is Jesus speaking. So, do you get the idea from all of this that God considers worship kind of important? You kind of get the picture here that there's a sense in which God says the gathering of the people together to worship is key? Let me punch a hole, or I'm sorry, I'm going to punch a hole in it. I'm going to wrap a rubber band around it, okay, with this. The nature of humanity is such that we must worship. The nature of humanity is such that we must worship. The imago Dei in us, the image of God in us, given to us when God breathed into that pile of dust and made it a living being, that image of God in us compels us to worship, for we know there is a Creator, and we know He is holy. In the fall, humans have replaced the worship of a creator they know exists and is worthy of worship with worship of things, right? Here's what Paul says in Romans chapter 1. For although they knew God, who? The whole world, everybody that lives here. For although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him, but they became futile in their thinking and their foolish hearts were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools. And exchange the glory of the immortal God for images, resembling mortal man and birds and animals and even creeping things. Oh, and by the way, in case you didn't catch the irony of that, the creeping things is the devil. Because that's the creeping thing of Genesis 3:1. What do? They create images because they have to worship something. They have to. All humanity has a desire to worship. I'm a science fiction fan. I'm one of those crazy people who actually thinks that their science fiction is fun. I like reading Arthur C. Clarke, by the way. He's one of my favorite because he's actually a realist when it comes to science fiction. He's not a science fantasy guy. He writes stuff that could actually happen, quote unquote. Okay? And he's one of those who was one of those who believed that, you know, man should shed this religiosity and this spirituality that he has because technology will eventually allow us and free us from this immature state of, you know, having to worship something because technology will solve it all. Isaac Asimov like this, and probably the greatest example of is Gene Roddenberry. Okay? But what these men failed to take into account is that every time technology comes along to try to stamp out that sense of needing to worship, human beings just flood right back in with worship of something. It just works every time. We are creatures that must worship. We know there's a creator. We know he's worthy of worship. In the fall, of course, we'll try to replace it, but we're compelled to worship. We must. We must fall down, bow down before something. Now, let me just posit a question here for a moment. Okay, you've been listening along to this, and you're thinking to yourself something along this line. If you're not, I am. Doesn't it seem to you rather conceited to create a race of humans explicitly to worship you? Now, some of you are going, I would never think that. Okay? I would never think that. Yeah, let's be honest about it, right? If I tell you that God created us to worship him, our fallen nature wants to turn that around and say, wow, that sounds conceited. God creating a race of people to bow down before him and worship him. How would we answer that? All right, let's answer that in two ways. Number one, where's really the conceit? The conceit is the one asking the question, isn't it? The one answering the question is the one that's conceited, because it's to assume a conceit on the part of God is, in fact, to lower him to our level. We make him one of us, right? We lower him to our level, and then we ask such a question. It's what we call in apologetics a straw man argument, right? It's not really true, and we set it up and then knock it down and say, see, I was right. The asker is the one that's conceited. It's to lower him to our level as though the creator is subject to the opinions of the creature. As though the one who creates us cares a whit about what we think. Because he does not. He doesn't. I'm sorry to break that to you. I'm sorry to be the one to tell you. God doesn't care what your opinion is. He doesn't care what you think of him. He doesn't care what you think of his son. He doesn't care what you think of how he created his world. He doesn't care what you think about. He doesn't care about any of that. You know why? Because he's God. If you don't believe me, read probably the best passage in all of this in the Bible, Romans 11, 33 to 36. Who has known the mind of God? Who has been his counselor? Who has ever given to God that God should repay him? Right? Who does God consult about anything? And the answer is nobody. So the conceit is not in God. The conceit is in us asking such a ridiculous question as creatures. But let's answer it in a positive sense. The very nature of God is such that he is worthy of worship regardless of whether he demands it or not. The nature of God is such that he is worthy of worship regardless of whether he demands it or not. Here's the problem. As human beings, we cannot even begin to fathom the nature of God. Okay? If you think you've got God figured out, you couldn't be more wrong. If I think I've got God figured out, No. He is so beyond our comprehension that the very idea of a creator who is absolutely infinite is something we cannot even fathom. For us, then, as creatures, because he is so beyond our comprehension, the right reaction of such a creature would be to fall down before this God in utter and absolute honor and glory to him, shedding all honor and glory to ourselves. Our problem is we live in a fallen world where we can't shed those things, right? It's impossible for us to actually worship God perfectly in understanding who he really is. Because our nature is, well, I'm pretty cool too, you know. So the nature of humanity is such that we are actually created by God to worship. And as Jesus himself said, it is God who is seeking those who will worship him in spirit and truth, right? Not in made-up religiosity and falsehood, but in reality, okay? So one of the very first things that we come into the reality of is that worship is central to the entire redemptive historical revelation of God. The concept of worship, the idea of a people gathering together to fall before this God and give him praise and thanks has never, ever, ever been an optional thing in this world, subject to our whims or desires or directions. It is the very essence of what we are created to be. Therefore, would it not be a fair statement to say that the church then should be, if Jesus is the one coming to seek worshipers, that its primary mission should be to worship? See why I put that first? In fact, I put that first because when I read the Great Commission, I read the whole paragraph, not just the part we like, but the whole paragraph. What did these men do? They walked into the presence of this Jesus and they worshiped him. They recognized who he was as the one worthy of worship. What's the implication? They recognized him as God. They recognized him as God. The only one, by the way, worthy of all worship. Okay, so the mission of the church, the first mission of the church, is worship. Okay, but what does this look like? What does it look like? Again, remember what I said at the beginning. What God is seeking is worship as he has demanded it, not how we think it ought to go. Because true worship isn't going to be worship as we make it up. The Samaritan woman is living proof of that. She had her little mountain temple up there and thought everything was cool because they worshiped there. And Jesus says, you missed it. No, that's not it. And no, it's not even going to be in Jerusalem in the temple. That's not even going to be the place of worship. There's going to come a time when the people are going to worship in an entirely different way than everything you've ever been taught or understand. But I'm going to dictate what that's going to be as the Lord of the church. So, what does it look like? Well, guess what you're going to have to do? You're going to have to come back next week to find out what it is. I love doing that. Never works, but I love doing that. So we are to be a worshiping people. The church is to have a mission of worship. And next week, Lord willing, we'll come back and we'll talk about the philosophy and structure or elements of worship as they are dictated by this Christ who is the Lord of the church.